Chariot Solutions TechCast, episode number 104, my conversation with Brian Bagnell, author of the Commodore Computer History Book series. I'm Ken Rimple. This episode is brought to you by Chariot Solutions Training Services, focusing on front-end browser application frameworks such as React and Angular. Has your team switched your front-end to the browser? Are you trying to use React and struggling with choices and approaches? Or has your enterprise shifted to using Angular, but it's too complex for your team to figure out given your current deadline pressure? You need help. And we at Chariot have courses in React and Angular we can tailor to suit your team's current level of expertise and challenges. Go to chariotsolutions.com/training and review our courses. Send us a request and we'll answer it with direct conversations, putting you in touch with experts that can craft a course offering to fit your exact needs. That's chariotsolutions.com/training for our private, on-site React and Angular courses. Contact us today. The episode this week features Brian Bagnell. He's an author who has a particular interest in the history of Commodore, a company that started out making business machines and fell into being one of the biggest innovators of personal computing in the 20th century. While Apple charged more than $1,000 for their Apple and Apple II computers, Commodore was selling C64s by the truckload at $299. Brian and I discussed the challenges of talking to past innovators, the changes they brought about, and how Commodore made an impact on them both personally and professionally. Brian Bagnell's books on Commodore, Commodore Company and the Edge, Commodore the Amiga Years, and his upcoming final book are linked to in the show notes. I hope you enjoy this episode of the podcast. So I'm talking today with Brian Bagnell. He's the author of a number of books on Commodore. What's your background and how'd you come about to approach this kind of project?
My background was originally with the Commodore 64, way back in the 80s, of course.
Yep.
And I just, I would say around the year 2000 or so, I don't know if you remember, there was a book called Accidental Empires by Robert Crinsley that came out. Mm-hmm. And that was really touting, it was purportedly, on the origins of the personal computing industry, mm-hmm. except it really favored Apple. Robert Crinsley was, one of the original employees at Apple, actually. And then that was made into Triumph of the Nerds, which was a PBS documentary. And then that sort of got the whole ball rolling where everybody was, giving Apple all this credit for really originating personal computers, back in 1977. And from my perspective, and I think the perspective of a lot of people, Apple was really kind of a very small company, and they didn't sell a whole lot of, they sold a lot of Apple IIs, but they didn't sell as many as companies like Radio Shack and Commodore did. And so from my perspective, I thought, well, Commodore had a much bigger role of popularizing home computers than Apple did. And I was sort of, waiting for someone to come along and do a book on that or, do something about Commodore. And it just never seemed to really happen. And then finally, at the time, I was actually writing computer books myself, although they were more more like computer technical books, mm-hmm. On programming and that sort of thing.
Right.
And I thought, well, all right, I'll give it a try. I'm close enough. And, writing historical nonfiction wasn't my forte exactly, but I thought, well, I could probably do it. And, I just started seeking out Commodore people. This was probably around 2002 or 2003 or so. And one by one, I sort of started piecing together the story and realized, wow, this Commodore story really is interesting. Because, I really hadn't known much about the Commodore background at that time.
That's kind of a neat project because, it's something you work with in your youth. You get to actually talk to the people who worked on these things. How did you actually go about finding people? Were you reading through, company reports and message boards and things like that?
Yeah, it was a way different process back then, around 2000 than it is now, actually. Because, the internet had been around for, as far as, the popular internet, let's call it, where there was, a web browser and everything.
Right.
That had been around since about, let's say, 1994 or 1995. But there weren't things like Facebook or Twitter or what are a few other, you know, there's a few other like social media type things that make, oh, LinkedIn, that's the other
oh,
big
yeah,
one.
Of course.
That make it way easier to find these people. So back then you sort of had to find someone's webpage, you know, whether it's, I think a guy like RJ Michael, you know, he had a webpage and he had his email on there. Dave Haney, you know, he was relatively easy to find. And then once you found them, you know, beg them to put you in touch with a few other Commodore people. So that was, yeah, that was the kind of the process. And somehow, I don't know how this happened. You know, you'd think my first interview would be with a Commodore engineer because, you know, they're more closer to the technical side of things and closer to the internet.
Right.
But somehow my first interview was the CEO of Commodore, Thomas Rattigan.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I don't even remember how I got in touch with him first, but I think it might have been, you know, phone book hunting, basically, or, you know, looking at...
Sleuthing, yeah.
Yeah, just some kind of sleuthing to track him down. And he turned out to be a great first interview because he's a real sort of people person. He put up with my, you know, inability to interview people really well, I gotta say. So I learned a lot on that first interview.
And so kind of... You know, opening up that whole Pandora's box of issues and politics and everything else. The thing I found striking about the book was you really did get into not only the technical side, but the way the company culture evolved and devolved, I guess, at different times. So I guess, you know, let's briefly kind of list your books here. So you've got Commodore Life on the Edge, which is kind of the from inception to before the Amiga. You've got the Amiga years, which is not just Amiga, obviously. It's the C128 and all the other things that were going on. And then you're working on this new one, this Commodore, the final years. And I thought, you know, as part of the interview, it might be interesting to kind of just pull a few stories out or a few people's names and talk a little bit about them. so first of all, you know, Jack Tramiel was kind of the heart of Commodore early on, right? So, you know, he helps take this calculator company and turn it into a computer company. Was it really his goal, or did he kind of fall into it?
Yeah, I think that would be a classic case of falling into it, sort of. Although he did, like, you know, he started Commodore way back in 1958, I
really?
Believe, in Canada, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he called his company Commodore because supposedly he saw he wanted to have sort of a military sounding name, but names like Admiral and General, you know, General Electric, General Mills, those were all sort of taken. And then he saw an Opel car, which I'd never really heard of before. I guess it's a European car.
Mm-hmm.
And Opel was made by a company called Commodore or something like that.
Really?
And is that right?
I'm assuming that's correct. I don't know. I thought it was made by Ford later on, but...
Okay. Yeah, I'm not too familiar with that, with those aspects, but that's the story I heard anyway.
Huh.
And so he it's called Commodore, but he would call his company CBM for short. And the reason for that was he wanted to be seen as an IBM competitor, even way back in, you know, the 50s and 60s. And so he was trying to sort of... His... product range was sort of anything in the office, which was what IBM was after. You know, there was even IBM typewriters and stuff like that back then as well. And he was sort of going after the same market. And so, you know, he was doing typewriters. He was doing adding machines, like mechanical adding machines. And then he got into calculators. And then because the calculators needed, you know, little microprocessors in them, that got him into buying a microprocessor company. And then as soon as you have a microprocessor company, of course, you know, that company wants to make computer chips. And so that's sort of how they got into computers, was through that company, MOS Technology.
And that's the connection with the Philadelphia area, right? Because MOS Technology was based there?
That's exactly right, yeah. Yeah, that's what drew them to Pennsylvania, and which is really strange, you know, like, all these computer companies, they're on the West Coast.
Yeah.
Commodore did have a little bit of a presence on the West Coast sort of in the late 70s, but eventually they moved the whole thing to Westchester, Pennsylvania, in I think around 1983 or so.
Now, Tramiel was well known for his management style, kind of the "how dare you duck when I throw that at you" kind of management style. How did people, when you were talking about Jack and discussing it, how did people recall him?
A lot more positive than you would think, given some of the anecdotes you hear. Because, mm-hmm. You know, he was a tough boss, sort of an old school boss. You know, like I'm sure as kids we've all read these comic strips where there's like, you know, all the comic strips have the terrible boss who's always yelling at his employees or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think that's a holdover of the, you know, the way bosses used to be.
Right.
And he was definitely, you know, that type of old school boss. But people were surprisingly favorable. Like, you know, every person I talked to, you know, they would say they learned a ton of stuff from him.
Yeah, you see
that guy's like, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Finish your thought.
Oh, just guys like Al Charpentier who, you know, he went on to become sort of an entrepreneur in his own right, doing a lot of different companies. And all those guys said, you know, that was their education, was working at Commodore under Jack Tramiel and just watching what he did in the business world.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. The term you hear in the book a lot is, the first book is the Jack Attack. What's a Jack Attack?
Yeah, that's, it's a video game that Commodore made that was based on what their boss did to them.
Oh my God, that's hilarious. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so, their boss, Jack Tramiel, would sort of, he didn't arbitrarily give Jack attacks, by the way. Like, he wasn't just out to yell at people for no reason.
Right.
There's a, you know, in any high-stakes, fast-moving business culture where they were just learning everything really back then, people would make a lot of mistakes, you know, from the engineers right up to management. And, you know, if you made a mistake, he would, and if you basically lost the company a lot of money, like the ones I was hearing, most of them, you know, they would lose the company $50,000 or sometimes, you know, $100,000. Sometimes they'd lose the company, you know, by just a simple engineering error would result in them producing a whole bunch of whatever, like a chip that they just couldn't use.
Right.
And so they would get a Jack attack.
And, they'd learn, hopefully. Yeah.
Yeah, they would. It would really, it burned it into their mind, I guess, not to make that same error again. And so he would just, the Jack attack was just a lot of people, when they try to describe a Jack attack, they can't really remember exactly what happened. And I think that's because it's coming at them so quickly, you know, they're being just shouted at. And so as the people tried to recall their Jack attacks, they would say, oh, basically he was just really personally attacking me and calling me every name under the sun and that kind of thing. But I think that's the gist of what a Jack attack was.
It's like the event. Don't talk about the event. Yeah. So,
yeah.
So he's working on these calculators. He seems to, you know, be getting somewhere with sales of them. I think they were pretty heavy in the calculator community. And then along comes Chuck Peddle. Why did he bring Chuck Peddle on board?
Actually, Chuck Peddle was one of, you could say, one of the founders of MOS Technology. So when Jack Tramiel acquired MOS Technology in about 1976, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck Peddle was part of that package. And, you know, so there's the way the acquisition happened, there's some people would say it was a little bit underhanded by Jack Tramiel. But he basically, from what I heard, he sort of starved the company. He owed the company some money because they were supplying him with chips. And so he got them to make a lot of chips for him. And then he sort of held off paying them. Some people say that was intentional, and some people say, well, Commodore literally just didn't have the money to do that. But the end result was that MOS Technology, you know, had spent a lot of money to make the chips, and then they didn't get it back from Commodore, and so they kind of went bankrupt. And then Jack Tramiel would snatch up the company for, you know, much less than it was actually worth.
That seems to be kind of a pattern, isn't it, in that industry? to a degree.
Yeah, like I'm sure people in the industry, you know, they learn little tricks like that that are a little bit, you know, they're probably perfectly legal, but they're also a little bit
underhanded,
you know, playing hardball, let's say.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he's one of those guys, he picked this up that, hey, I can do this move. And then he kind of repeated that move several times from what I've heard to acquire other companies.
Yeah. Now, so Chuck Peddle comes along, right? And is basically, I guess the reason they wanted the chip companies because it was better to fabricate their own chips than to go out and get them from other organizations. But Chuck had a bigger idea than just calculators, right?
Yes. Yeah. He had a real vision. That's actually, he told me that was the reason he made the 6502 chip, was because he wanted to create a standalone computer that was basically like, you know, back then everybody had mainframe computers, and then you'd have a terminal that was off in some other part of the building or whatever that was connected to the mainframe.
Right.
And, you know, that was the state of the art computing back in the 70s. And, you know, when he came from Motorola, when he was working there, he realized, you know, this chip does everything that the chip in the mainframe computer does, you know, not as powerful and not as much memory and all that. So he wanted to create the same abilities that you'd get from a terminal, but do it all in one standalone unit that you could then sell to individuals in small businesses and, you know, maybe even their homes as well. So that was his vision, and that's why the computer he ended up making, the Commodore PET, that's why it really looks like a terminal, you know, the graphics capabilities and all that.
And if you take it all the way through, like, you know, the life cycle of this whole platform, you know, you get the PET, they have the KIM for people who are learning how to program the hardware, they've got eventually get into the VIC-20, they get into the VIC Commodore 64 and the C64 Plus and all this. They went down the consumer angle. And I think one of the interesting things about the book that kind of unfolds over time is that tension of Chuck wanting to move this into a, you know, significant lower cost personal computing power. And it seems to me that Tramiel was going for, well, how cheap can we get it and how can we sell it to the masses? And that seemed to be like a big tension between them.
Yeah, and looking back on that, for that period, like, I think Jack Tramiel changed his strategy after he moved to Atari.
Mm-hmm.
But looking back, you can see why he thought that, which was he came from the calculator market, and really the most important thing in the calculator market wasn't, like, better graphics for your calculator.
Right.
Or, you know, better sound or... even, you know, calculators, as soon as you push that equal button, it spits out the answer. It's not like a calculator is slow and has to think a lot. So he wasn't thinking in terms of faster processors either.
Right.
You know, his vision of the computer was, well, this is just a calculator, but kind of bigger. And so he, you know, when he had been in the calculator business, the focus was always on reduce the price, reduce the price, reduce the price. That's how you succeeded in the calculator market. And he wanted the same thing with computers and saw that as the same thing. But he kind of, he got sort of lucky in a way, I guess you could say, that he had a guy like Al Charpentier. And Bob Yannis was another guy who designed the sound chip and co-designed the graphics chip. That they were able to, you know, make a cheaper computer while at the same time really improving the graphics and sound capabilities of that computer. And that's where they had their mega hit with the Commodore 64. So even though they did that, Jack Tramiel's vision was never like make better specs for this machine. It was always drive down the price.
Right.
That's how that sort of panned out.
Like an old school retail guy.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. He knew retail. You know, everybody I talked to said this guy knew how to market really well.
And so, you know, we go through that first book is really fascinating for just seeing how these products emerge and the push of the bottom line. And can we get this to $250? Can we, you know, redesign the circuit boards to make it, you know, cheaper? And but, you know, at the same time, you've got this whole project chip fab, basically, that they've created at MOS Technology. So I guess... As Commodore grew and it became something where the Amiga came into the picture, you know, how did MOS technology kind of evolve?
I would say MOS technology sort of dropped the ball on evolving in a way. Although there were plenty of talented people in MOS technology, and the other aspect, it took me a while to figure this out, but MOS technology, you know, originally that company designed all the chips and produced them. And then with Commodore, when the acquisition happened, there was kind of a transfer where MOS technology then became just manufacturing chips. And the design aspect of those chips came from a group within Commodore called the Commodore Semiconductor Group. I'm kind of getting a little bit ahead of the story probably with that, but that's how that evolved. And yeah, one of the big puzzles, which I think is probably, if you could trace it back to Jack Tramiel, was that he didn't see a reason to make faster and more powerful chips, you know, like 16-bit chips and 32-bit chips and so on. He saw, you know, we've got this 8-bit chip, the 6502. How do we make it cheaper? You know, I think that was more of his priority with MOS technology. And, you know, a lot of the original guys like Bill Mensch was a very key player on the design of the 6502. He ended up leaving MOS technology. And he was the guy who ended up making a 16-bit chip that was, you know, backward compatible with the 6502. So, you know, I guess just to have, the short of that is they didn't evolve basically, they didn't evolve properly. Didn't carry on the spirit of the chip, you know, in the way that MOS technology probably should have.
Right, and it seems like, you know, with Bill Mensch going out and doing the Western Design Center, you know, eventually figuring out that they could do the designs and then get it manufactured overseas, you know, and other things coming in later in the game. You know, along comes the Amiga team, right? And the Amiga team was using an off-the-shelf chip, right? They were using the 68000 from Motorola. And then they were building, you know, their co-processors. But how did the Amiga team acquisition change Commodore?
I think I would say that it almost derailed Commodore for a period there, away from real consumer-oriented machines. Because, you know, prior to that, Commodore was all about the low-cost machines that you could even sell in Toys R Us and Kmart and places like that. And then when they got the Amiga, they began to believe that they were like a legitimate competitor to Apple and IBM.
Right.
And they kind of weren't, like... they didn't have, you know, like the back end thing that's not too obvious to us is that if you want to sell IBM type computers and you want to sell Apple computers into business, you've got to have a marketing department that has access to, you know, buyers of business computers and that sort of thing. And Commodore just didn't have that whole, you know, back end infrastructure in their company to do that kind of thing. So yeah, that was the big change when they got the Amiga, was they thought, oh, we're gonna compete with Apple, and Apple was flying really high on the stock market at that time. You know, right. They were sort of an industry darling, and Commodore wanted to become like Apple. So they started doing a lot of things that their company wasn't really made for. You know, their company was probably never gonna be like Apple, and they probably shouldn't have tried to be like Apple. You know, they probably should have tried to continue to own the home market and, you know, giving products to all those teenagers and, you know, people like that who would buy their products.
It was really strange too, because, you know, I, like you, I started with the Commodore 64 and I loved that thing. And, you know, peeking and poking into memory locations and programming a little bit of assembly and all that stuff, or at least machine code and the BASIC that came with it. It was a great platform to learn how to program. And a lot of people in our generation did that. But then I went right along with the interest of where the Amiga was going. And in fact, as I was getting ready to go to college, I got myself an Amiga 1000. Mm-hmm. And I think despite Commodore, Amiga turned out to be an amazing platform. Isn't that kind of the arc there, is that a company, despite itself, creates an amazing technology they don't know how to manage and they don't know how to sell.
Yeah, although it did have, I think, a real strong impact on what other companies like Apple and IBM. When you say IBM, you have to sort of say, well, IBM and the clones, you know, it's a
whole
whole ecosystem there with the IBM stuff. But I think the Amiga and Commodore really influenced their direction as far as, you know, where they had to go with graphics and sound.
Yeah.
Because the Amiga was just, you know, so far ahead of everyone else in that department that, you know, and looking back, it really was a missed opportunity. I think the Amiga 1000, the way they marketed it, and, you know, marketing even includes the pricing of it and that sort of thing. It was just a little bit too far out of the price range of most, you know, let's say Commodore 64 owners.
Right.
Until they came out with the Amiga 500, but, you know, maybe they should have. Maybe the Amiga 500 should have been the first thing that they launched in 1985 instead of trying to sort of capture that Macintosh market, you know, with the Amiga 1000.
You know, I think I was crazy because I went through the Amiga 1000. And then in college, I was able to pick up an Amiga 3000. And yeah, so I was really hacking on this thing, right? But all the way through computer science, I could find compilers and build tools and, you know, ways of building my projects without going into the COBOL mainframe room, you know, and working on old green screens. The one thing they had over a lot of companies back then was true multitasking. I thought that was amazing. Like on a floppy disk system, I could be doing a compile on one thing and then, you know, editing text in another window. That platform was amazing. What was it like talking to RJ Michael and, you know, how they developed this thing? Because that was a completely innovative operating system. They stole from other places, obviously. They looked at the Park system just like Apple did. But what made him so interested in the multitasking in the user interface?
The multitasking part, that was the idea of a guy, Carl Sassenrath, who came from Hewlett-Packard. Carl Sassenrath interviewed at Amiga, and he told them, you know, basically he wanted to do that type of operating system that was multitasking and had a whole bunch of features that were similar to Unix at that time. And they recognized him as, you know, being just a brilliant guy, and so they hired him on right away. You know, even though the computer that they were going to do this on was really limited compared to, you know, most types of business computers at the time, as far as, you know, the Amiga 1000 didn't even have a hard drive.
Right.
And, you know, it's just kind of incredible that he was able to do a full multitasking system on a computer with such limited specs. But he did, and it worked just amazingly.
And so the person who created the Amiga, or the main person in charge of it, was Jay Miner. And he was kind of a character, right?
Yeah. He was sort of a larger-than-life guy, from what people say. And not in any bad way. Like,
right.
You know, people said he was a real fatherly figure.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he also, you know, he was just a very large guy, like a very tall guy and a big guy. And you know, had a love for life, as far as, you know, he'd do square dancing pretty seriously, if you can believe it. And he owned a yacht that he spent a lot of time on. Everybody I talked to just said he was the absolute best mentor to have if you were getting into chip design at that time. And he was kind of a legend in the Valley, actually, because he'd done so many other chips at Atari prior to coming to Amiga.
And that was one of the interesting things about the Amiga, was they set up these different coprocessors, right? They had different kind of colorful names, right?
Yeah. There was like the Agnes chip and the Denise chip and Porsche chip that did different things. And that whole architecture of, you know, having a chip that sort of specializes in one area went back to the way things were designed in the Atari chipset, you know, with the Atari 400 and 800 computers.
Coming back around then, just overall, you've got these three books, right? We've talked a little bit about some of the stories in the first and second books. What's coming up with the Commodore and kind of the end game book?
Yeah, this is, you know, of course, as the time period and the name suggest, is the final descent of Commodore, where the company basically, you know, fails to exist after 1994. And it just goes over what they were trying to do through those years as far as evolving the Amiga technology. A lot of challenges they had evolving the Amiga technology. And they also had a lot of challenges as far as management at the company. You know, every engineer you talked to basically said, you know, the management was really pretty clueless throughout that time period. And they actually, you know, we're talking a lot about the Amiga, but the, you know, the Commodore's big hit throughout this whole period was the Commodore 64.
Right.
And they were actually trying to continue the legacy of the Commodore 64 with some kind of follow-up product. They kind of did that with the Commodore 128, although it wasn't quite what C64 owners wanted, probably. You know, the main criticism of the Commodore 128 was that it didn't really have a sequel to the VIC chip in it that people would have expected, you know, like the Commodore VIC-20 had the VIC-1 chip. The Commodore 64 had the VIC-2 chip. They kind of wanted like a VIC-3 chip that would have better resolutions, more colors, maybe more sprites or better sprites or things like that. And so Commodore finally, like I would say around 1987 or so, finally somehow concluded, oh, okay, we need to improve that as well. And so they started making a sort of a true Commodore 64 sequel in that time period, which was called eventually the Commodore 65, C65. Yeah, that story is covered in there as well, and it's pretty interesting. I think, you know, almost as interesting as all the Amiga stuff, really.
Yeah, and I know Amiga had a huge run with the video industry, with the video toaster and stuff like that. Are you going to get more into that in the final years as well?
Yeah, the video toaster stuff was really interesting because that was, like, you know, today we really take all these pre-rendered graphics for granted and, you know, how we can manipulate video very easily today. But back then, there were no other computers that did that at all, or at least personal computers, other than the Amiga. Like, the Amiga really handled video, you know, really well, and it was used in a lot of professional Hollywood productions at that time. And it really, really kind of gave the computer a niche market throughout that period that kept it afloat in North America.
Isn't Star Trek The Next Generation done on an Amiga? I thought I read that somewhere.
I believe it might be Star Trek Voyager that was done with Video Toaster, yeah. And a few other things, like Back to the Future 2 had some Amiga visual effects. And even actually, you know, we're getting into the early 90s.
Yeah.
You know, seems like it was recent in my mind, but Jurassic Park was, you know, that thing's like 20 years old or something. You know, that was getting started around that time. And they used Amigas for pre-visualizing a lot of the visual effects in that movie. So it really did, you know, it had a foothold in Hollywood as far as visual effects.
Amazing. So where do we go to purchase the product? You're doing everything on a Kickstarter campaign, right?
That's right. Yeah. Right now, there's a Kickstarter campaign for the final years that's going to last until, I believe, May 15th is the final day of that Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, if anyone's interested in the book, you can come to the Kickstarter. I guess the best way to find it on Kickstarter is just, you know, go to Kickstarter and type Commodore or Amiga, and you'll see my project listed right up there. You know, you'll see a picture of the book and everything. It should be pretty easy to find.
And for the other two volumes, are they available on Amazon or places like that?
Yeah, you can find Commodore the Amiga Years on Amazon, and, you know, I'm sure Barnes & Noble and probably bookstores as well. If the bookstore doesn't have it, you can ask them to order it in. And Commodore, the company on the edge, is that's been out of print actually for a little while. But you can still get that in ebook form.
Great. Okay. Well, Brian Bagnalli, really appreciate you taking the time with you today. This is a great topic.
Yeah. Oh, thanks for. I'm glad you're interested in this stuff, Ken.
I love it. Yeah, those two first books were fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for listening to my interview with author Brian Bagnall. If you want to order his books on Commodore, you can visit the show notes at chariotsolutions.com/techcast or head to Amazon and search for him by name. Thanks to Brian for coming on the show. We've recently held our IoT Fusion conference in Philadelphia, and the talks are now coming online. Visit that show's page at iotfusion.net to see which talks are online, or visit chariotsolutions.com/screencasts for all of our videos, including 2017's Philly Emerging Tech Conference and other shows. We will also write about topics on our blog page, as our developers all have a variety of interests. Pretty good place to check out what we're doing, and that's at chariotsolutions.com/blog. And if you're a Java, Scala, mobile, or JavaScript developer in the Philly area who wants to work with an innovative team of your peers, come work for us. Visit our recruiting page at chariotsolutions.com/jobs to find out what we're looking for and how to apply. For the Chariot Solutions TechCast, I'm Ken Rimple.